TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Stephen Cohen and Helen Caldicott. The Ukraine Crisis. Is Nuclear Conflict Likely? In part one of this program, you heard a talk by Dr. Helen Caldicott. She gave it at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on October 8, 2014. The lifelong anti-nuclear campaigner said, "The world is in a very dangerous situation. The first time since the Cold War ended, the nuclear-armed nations, Russia and America, are confronting each other militarily." And later in this program, you will hear part of the question and answer period of her appearance at the press club. But before that, here's more background to the story that all participants agree has not been covered in the mainstream media or even in the three large newspapers of record, which includes the New York Times. 2 days after Dr. Helen Caldicott's talk, Stephen Cohen, the eminent scholar of Russian studies from Princeton, gave an extensive interview to Sophie Shevardnadze on RT. Formerly called Russia Today, this is the Russian cable and satellite TV channel that is aimed at an international audience. Here are clips from that interview with thanks and credit to RT. This is Sophie Shevardnadze.
Now, you've called the current U.S.-Russia crisis the most dangerous confrontation in many decades. Are we close to war?
Let me tell you what I think happened. We are in a new Cold War. In America, the policymakers say it's not a Cold War because they don't want to take responsibility for it. Because their policies, and not just recently, since the 1990s, have led to a new Cold War. It began before, I think, the Ukrainian crisis. But what happened in Ukraine is that about a year ago, in November 2013, there was a political dispute in Kiev about whether Yanukovych would sign the agreement with the EU. That political dispute, after the coup in February, became a Ukrainian civil war, generally speaking, between Kiev and the southeast of Ukraine. The civil war then became what we call a proxy war, with the United States and NATO supporting Kiev and Moscow supporting the eastern Ukrainian rebels. The danger is that the proxy war would lead, by accident or intention, to the intervention of Russian military forces in the east, NATO forces in the west, and that would be the Cuban Missile Crisis. If the ceasefire fails, if, let's say, Kiev attacks the Donbas again, if Russia feels the need to help the Donbas militarily, it is being discussed in NATO, the possibility of NATO forces entering western Ukraine. Now, what would that mean? You would have the American-led NATO forces in western Ukraine, Russian forces in the air or on the ground, and that would be a modern version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have to think the unthinkable, because who knew 2 years ago we were going to be in a completely...
Well, the unthinkable is nuclear weapons being involved. Do you think that that's a possibility as well?
Well, let's look what's happened. Russia has the position, the doctrine, they've had it since the 1990s, that because Russian conventional forces are weaker than American NATO conventional forces, Russia reserves the right to use nuclear weapons if Western conventional forces threaten the Russian state and Russia. Meanwhile, as was announced in the New York Times on the front page, maybe 2 weeks ago, I forget, that President Obama is about to sign a budgetary decree for what he calls a major modernization of our nuclear arsenal at the cost of $1 trillion over 30 years. $1 trillion is only the cost today. It doesn't include overrun, inflation. It's a fortune. Meanwhile, your government has been, quote, modernizing its nuclear weapons. But let's talk as adults. What does the word modernization mean? It means buildup. So both sides are now building up their nuclear weapons. We're in a new Cold War, we're beginning a new nuclear arms race, and the dangers are immense.
Mm-hmm. always another huge problem between the two is the sanctions, the imposed sanctions. Now, Moscow insists that it did not help push for a ceasefire over the situation in Ukraine and Minsk to actually stop the sanctions, but it helped it because restoring peace in Ukraine is much more important for Russia. But then you have the West that's always tying the sanctions to the agreement made in Minsk over Ukraine. Why is that?
Well, let's talk about what sanctions mean, first of all. It's an institutionalization of the new Cold War. Politically, and particularly with the presidential campaign coming in America, which candidate is going to say 2 years from now, things are good with us in Russia, I propose removing the sanctions? Not one. They'll think it's dangerous and unpopular.
No, they're actually, the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate is actually thinking of turning this whole sanction thing into part of a law.
That's right. This law by what I call the war party in the Senate, it's not the whole Senate, it's the war party, Republican and Democratic, have been drafting a very harsh Cold War law to punish Russia in many ways, and moreover, make it possible to send American weapons to countries that are not members of NATO, but were former parts of the Soviet Union. They've got a long list, and not only Ukraine. This is a reckless, dangerous law. It's not clear what will pass. Some senators are against it. But in this political atmosphere, it might pass. Now, of course, Obama could veto it. Well, we don't know that it'll get to Obama. It's got to go out of committee, then it's got to go to the full Senate, then it's got to get a majority, and then it's got to go to Obama. I don't know. We're not sure what Obama does from day to day. I mean, he changes his mind. Now, if the Ukrainian civil war begins again, if Kiev and the southeast begin fighting and shooting and shelling and the rest, then I think Obama would sign it. But if the ceasefire and negotiations are unfolding, I don't think Obama would rush to sign this. But the strange thing is that you need to explain, and I'm not sure I can completely, is why were new sanctions brought against Russia just as Putin and Poroshenko agreed on the ceasefire and negotiations? That's a kind
and why the sanctions are tied into the agreement made in Minsk?
Because that's what I'm saying,
the agreement is about ceasefire, not about sanctions.
That's right. No, they agreed in Minsk, and suddenly these sanctions were imposed. I think, I can't prove it, that this was a compromise between Chancellor Merkel of Germany, who has a softer approach toward Russia, wants to end this and get back to business as usual, and the war parties in NATO and in Washington. And there was a compromise agreement where the sanctions were something that Merkel agreed to in return for something she got.
Many believe that NATO expansion is the main stumbling point between Russia and the West.
Look, when NATO expansion began in the 1990s, the late George Kennan, who was considered the wisest man in America about American-Russian relations, said this is a terrible, reckless, stupid decision, and it will lead to a new Cold War. 20 years later, George was correct. Major decision was taken under Clinton to do it. And it was a catastrophically unwise decision, and not only because it led to conflict with Russia, but what it said to all these new countries in NATO that had been part of the Soviet bloc is you don't have to have normal diplomatic relations with Russia. That the Baltics don't have to negotiate with Russia about the rights of Russian-speaking people there. You don't have to negotiate. Georgia, who thought it was going to get into NATO at one time, you don't have to negotiate. You can punch Russia in the nose and hide behind NATO. How much diplomacy is going on? Very little. That was one of the bad things about NATO expansion. It was the end of diplomacy between Eastern Europe and Russia. The expansion of NATO was done for one main purpose, to increase security in Europe. It did just the opposite.
That was Stephen Cohen, the scholar of Russian studies from Princeton, who's teaching at New York University. He's the author of many books and essays, including the 2011 Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. Many thanks to Sophie Shevardnadze and RT. 2 days before this interview took place, on October 8, 2014, Dr. Helen Caldicott spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. If you missed the broadcast of her speech, you can get a free download on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org on the newest programs page. Here now are parts of the Q&A period, and you can see some of the problems with press coverage just in the nature of those questions. The first question was a challenge of sorts. A press corps member interjected, "But we need nuclear weapons for defense." Helen Caldicott.
Well, first of all, nuclear weapons are no defense. They vaporize millions and billions of people. That's not defense. It's a euphemism. It's like we had to destroy the village to save it. One. Two, America's in the hot seat. If America decided with great morality to work with Russia to produce nuclear disarmament of 94% of the weapons in the world, then America would have the authority to say to Israel, get rid of your bombs. I don't know if Israel would, but they do have tremendous power in Israel. They give them, what, $3 billion a year in weapons, and they give Egypt $3 billion a year too in weapons. So there, it has enormous leverage.
The U.S. can't get Israel to move its settlers, for God's sake.
Yeah, but that's because of the huge, you know, AIPAC, and they've got everyone tied up, and everyone in the Senate voted to support Israel, so they've got everyone tied up. And America could say to India and Pakistan, get rid of your bombs. You see not the mote in the other person's eye, look instead for the mote in your own eye. You can only lead by example. The only country that can change itself, and America's led the nuclear arms race at every step of the way except one, and Russia blindly and stupidly copied and followed. And because America's big into exporting nuclear power plants to any country, they're bomb factories. Because each reactor makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year. You need 10 pounds to make a bomb. It lasts for 500,000 years. So, you know, this government may not make a bomb, but they've got stores. Japan's got 40 tons of stockpiled plutonium. Within weeks, Japan could make nuclear weapons. Well, we've got to stop exporting nuclear power plants, which are cancer factories and bomb factories. That's just the truth. And so any country is going to be able to build a bomb.
That's Helen Caldicott's answer to a question at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. She had given a talk entitled, "The Ukraine Crisis, Is Nuclear Conflict Likely?" Even though the next member of the press was not sure for how long the U.S. has had nuclear weapons, he claimed that there had been not a single accident.
Yes, you have. You've dropped nuclear weapons out of planes in Greenland and in North Carolina and stuff, but they haven't blown up. That's true.
Right. So can we just keep our fingers crossed?
No, because as a physician, you know, I was once working in the casualty department. In came a man about 89. He'd broken his neck. And he said, "I've been driving for 60 years and I've never had an accident."
Yeah.
That proves nothing. That's not logical. At all to say that. Well, we haven't had a nuclear war, therefore, you know, the nuclear weapons have prevented us having a nuclear war. No, the reverse is true. The nuclear weapons are sitting there ready to have a nuclear war at any tick of the clock. We're just damn lucky. I mean, I wrote a book called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, and I, as a doctor, I took the history of all the near misses and what's been going on, and then I examined the patient, which was the planet, and then I made a prognosis from that data. I honestly don't understand how we're still here, Tony. And, you know, we're all practicing psychic numbing. We're, you know, we deny it, and we're like lemmings marching towards the cliff of nuclear annihilation, not even realizing. We're into manic denial, clothes, food. Just look at the New York Times and it's got a whole section on food, whole section on fashions. Yeah, it's lovely and I love food and fashions too, but the real issue facing the continuation of life on the planet is the one I've talked about today and global warming and the nuclear power plants. I once asked Carl Sagan years ago, who's a close friend, "Do you think there's other life in the universe?" And he paused for a long time. And he said, "No." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because if any species had reached our stage of evolution, they would have destroyed themselves." And other people are saying that now. And what I haven't talked about is artificial intelligence. The computers are becoming so good now, within 10 years, say Hawking, Stephen Hawking and Max Tegmark, MIT, it's so brilliant that they're going to take over everything humans do. There'll be virtually no jobs for humans. They will be so smart they'll be able to reproduce themselves. You can't program morality or conscience into a computer. And a recent article in the Atlantic Monthly quoting Hawking and others saying that, in fact, computers could start a nuclear war by themselves. So I am organising a symposium in the New York Academy of Medicine in February called The Dynamics of Possible Human Extinction, talking about these computers and getting the best minds that there are. And it's fascinating because they're worried. They can't stop themselves working on AI, artificial intelligence. Isn't that typical of the left brain?
The next questioner challenged Helen Caldicott's thesis that we are today in a new Cold War. Are there any Cold Warriors around anymore? The press person asked.
Yes, there are, and they appear on television all the time, like Cheney, and I don't know if Richard Pearl has popped up, but, you know, Wolfowitz, the really bad ones. Why don't they get people from Physicians for Social Responsibility and scientists to educate the people? I think the American media has a large role to play in this. It was like the New York Times, who published 5 front-page articles by Judith Miller about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and she was having relationships with Scooter Libby, I'm fairly sure. And that induced, you know, that was very useful for the neocons to move into Iraq. The media is being absolutely, absolutely irresponsible. And they're saying Putin's to blame. Well, imagine if Russia decided to, you know, move into Canada and say, well, we're taking over Canada, the Canadians want us to, etc. America would blow up the world. Remember what happened in Cuba. We nearly had a nuclear war. Little tiny Cuba, because the Russians put some missiles there. They're going to put anti-ballistic missiles, and they want the Ukraine to join NATO. And what happened after the Cold War was that America promised Gorbachev that they would not expand NATO into the former Eastern Bloc countries. The opposite happened. And I did the research, and Lockheed Martin and the president, I can't remember his name, went to all these Eastern European countries informing them about NATO and encouraging them. Now, to join NATO, you have to have a certain level of militarism. So you have to buy weapons from Lockheed Martin, et al. And that's what's happened. America violated its compact with Gorbachev, and it's moved right up to the border of Russia. How provocative. How dare they, you know? And America says the world's policeman. Well, we don't like being policed. I speak as an Australian now, and it's got over 1,000 military bases all over the world, including in Africa. It's very dangerous and incredibly autocratic and unnecessary. So this is very, very provocative towards Russia, and I think they'd like a new Cold War again because it's very good for the profits of the military-industrial complex. And in fact, Hillary Clinton today or yesterday was talking about an endless war. And Obama said, you know, it might take 20 years to beat ISIS. Well, now they're talking about 30 years. An endless war? Very good for the military-industrial complex, but God help us. When are we going to stop killing each other? And in my book, why do we glorify war? Why do we glorify killers? Why has Napoleon got a tomb in Paris and he killed thousands or hundreds of thousands of people in the name of France? What are we on about? And, you know, I get on a plane and they say, we honour our fighting people, you know, you go on first. But the poor little boys, they're only about 18, they're cannon fodder. And they join the army because they're poor and they can get some education. Why is God always behind the killers? Be they Muslims, be they the French, be they Americans, you know, be they Christians, God's always on your side. It's really, anyway, I don't think there is a God. Sorry to offend anyway.
Helen Caldicott. The next question was, what's your recommendation?
Well, my recommendation is the media is determining the fate of the earth. And as President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. This democracy is thoroughly ill-informed, and I would lay a lot of the blame at the feet of my fellow countryman, Rupert Murdoch, who championed me, created my career in the 70s when I was taking on the French nuclear tests in Australia, front-page editorials championing me. Then when I started on uranium mining, that was it. He's got two little girls. I do not understand the man. He's 81 and you think, oh, good. But his mother lived to 101. Look, he's been so dangerous. And then the whole of the media is emulating Fox and the way they go. It's terribly dangerous.
Helen Caldicott. Then she was asked how she and Physicians for Social Responsibility arrived at their success in the 1980s, bringing about a huge anti-nuclear movement to help end the Cold War.
First of all, you have to teach the people, like Mrs. Brown, who's got four kids. And I used to go during the Cold War and look at Mrs. Brown loading a trolley up with crates of coke and think, if she doesn't know about it, we're nowhere. And over 5 years, we educated the American people about the medical dangers of nuclear war. And in 5 years, from everyone really supporting Better Dead Than Red, 80% opposed it. That was really the second American Revolution, and it was done through teaching. I was often on television. I had an agent in Hollywood who had film stars. They didn't want me on television talking about nuclear war, but if, you know, we had Candy Bergen and Lily Tomlin and Sally Field with me, yeah, they'd have me. And so people learnt. They became educated. The doctors have to get on the media and talk about this. Now, talk about policy considerations. Once the people demand that things change, then the politicians start moving. I would go to the Congress and I could get Tip O'Neill off the House floor and come and see me in his office. He'd say, what can I do for you, doctor? Because he knew we had 80% of people supporting us. That's political power. Without the people and without the democracy being used, and this is not being used at the moment, you've got no hope. And how do you get people power? By teaching, educating all the time. The scientists need to come out of their labs and tell the people what they're doing with science. The doctors need to talk about what is happening and educate. It's called global public health, which is what I practice.
The next member of the press asked about the films made about Helen Caldicott.
See If You Love This Planet, that was made by the Canadian Film Board. It's half an hour long, and it's me giving a lecture to an audience, like I did today, only very medical and scientific. And I end up by saying, if you love this planet, you will change the way you live. And although the haircuts are different, it's totally topical to now. Go to my webpage, helencaldicott.com, and you'll be able to download it and watch it. That should be played all over the world. It's never been played in America because it was banned as foreign propaganda by the US Justice Department. You have to register with the Justice Department to play it, so it's been banned, along with two films on acid rain. It went to the Congress. There were hearings under an old law in the 40s against communism or something. It was still banned. Then it was taken to the Supreme Court, and it's still banned. Anyway, I play it wherever I can. They can take me to jail if they want.
And the last questioner asked Helen Caldicott to comment on a news story. This is what he said, quote, President Obama announced that one of the elite units of the U.S. Army, the Iron Horse Brigade, was being deployed not just in Poland, but in the three former Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which were, of course, the invasion routes which the Nazis used to march to St. Petersburg and Leningrad, where they killed 1 million people in the Great Siege in World War II. Now, how dangerous is that? And how will the Russians assess it? Here is Helen Caldicott's answer.
The Russians are terribly paranoid. They lost 27 million people in the Second World War. I remember standing in the kitchen as a little girl, about 3 or 4, and my mother said, he's turned against Russia. Thank God he'll never beat Russia, Hitler. The Second World War was won against Russia. They were the ones that really won it, not America. And they are very sensitive about what they went through. And it's extreme, and they're very, feel very strongly being Russians. They're very proud people. They're very emotional. Read Chekhov, read, you know, all the authors, and you'll know. But that's extremely provocative. How dare America do that? How dare they? Are they really wanting to have a war with Russia, and the only war they can have with Russia is a nuclear war? Is that what they really want, the neocons in the State Department? Is that what they're aiming for? Because they're certainly moving towards that.
You heard the Q&A section of a press conference that the anti-nuclear campaigner and author, Dr. Helen Caldicott, gave on October 8, 2014, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. While living in the U.S., she brought Physicians for Social Responsibility out of a long dormancy, the umbrella organization, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, won the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. Her most recent book is Crisis Without End, an anthology about the current and future danger of Fukushima. Many thanks to the National Press Club newsmakers in Washington for allowing me to use the audio of this luncheon, and to the RT Washington, D.C. office for the clips from their interview of Russia expert Stephen Cohen. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org or 707-463-2654 for more information. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and passing out. The precious moments to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.